you jackass.
Welcome to the Jackass Critics Podcast with your hosts, Tom and Matt.
Wow, and welcome to the Jackass Critics Podcast. I am your host, Tom. I'm joined, as always, by Jackass Matt. How's it going, Ed Broden?
Absolutely wonderful. And yourself, Tom?
I'm doing great, doing great, doing great. Doing
looking
great.
Forward to a stimulating conversation this evening.
Yeah, I hope so. I've been looking forward to this for a while. I think we've been talking about Hour of the Wolf by Ingmar Bergman for a long time. I know you saw it many, many years ago, maybe 10 years ago. Okay, maybe it's not that many.
But you saw it. It feels like it, yeah.
Yeah, but it started off a pretty interesting conversation at that point, and I think it's one of those Ingmar Bergman movies that doesn't get discussed very often, but we will discuss it today on our show, on our little podcast,
yep.
After we talk about something more important.
Obviously.
And that's the NFL season coming up, and as you know, anytime an NFL season starts up, I kick off a Madden version on my PS2 that is about 5 years older than the current season. So I'm on Madden 2008 right now.
Yeah, and is it still surviving your PS2? Like, obviously that's an important factor in the survival of your Madden series. What's the status of the PS2? Is it doing okay?
It's loud.
Is it making noises? Is it pretty loud?
Yeah, there's some weird pauses at times. There's some crunching sounds that are going on.
Okay.
But so far, no loss of data.
Now, are you typing in, like, the names of new
No, I don't have to do that. Stuff? I don't have to do that. I have resigned myself to the fate that if I'm going to be playing at the college level,
yes,
that I'll just make up completely new names, and I will immerse myself in the fantasy of those new college players.
Good. All right. So how's the season going thus far?
So far, so good. What I like about playing these old Madden seasons is that I get to finally realize the full potential of quarterbacks who, for whatever reason or other, never reached their full potential in the NFL. Patrick Ramsey, Tulane graduate, Tulane University graduate, former first-round pick, or maybe it was early second round. 3 games in, he has like 12 touchdowns for me. So
kidding. Is his backup Sean King? I mean, I hope.
His backup is Byron Leftwich.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, I know you want to get to something slightly more important than my boring Madden.
You did flip me there. I was really excited to talk about, you know, the most important part of the podcast.
I flipped you for real.
I like what you did there, yeah. So, in our last podcast, we did what is commonly called the Summer Box Office Challenge.
Thank you for taking that over, Matt. I was just gulping my beer at that.
Yeah,
if
there's a pause, I'll slip in there. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, so we did our Summer Box Office Challenge, of which I was 2-0. 2011, undefeated. 2012 were...
Some people were saying undefeatable.
Yeah, they were magical years for me when it came to drafting our box office picks.
You're like the Iron Mike Tyson of the Summer Box Office Challenge.
That's correct. And there were definitely some pitfalls that you fell into in both year one and year two.
Fair statement.
And I figured you would just, through nature and inertia, fall into those pits one more time. And then one more time, and then one more time, year after year.
Yeah.
So I would say that there was a certain arrogance level about me when I picked M. Night Shyamalan's After Earth with my fourth pick.
Well, I mean, it didn't seem as terrible of a pick at the time as it does now.
I had
plenty of justification. Even universally panned M. Night Shyamalan movies, as we discussed at the time, were making $200 million. I mean,
well, maybe not $200 million, but they were making enough to the point where I could justify a pick. And there's the Will Smith factor that goes along with it. And we really didn't know how bad it was going to be.
Right? No one expected what happened, I suspect, I guess. I mean,
we all, in our own ways, root against M. Night Shyamalan. I don't think there's any one of us who's rooting for M. Night Shyamalan at this point.
Unfortunately, it has gotten to that point. I mean, he certainly has fallen from darling to wrestling heel at this point.
Yeah. I think there are some people who still want to see him pull out the... you know, I see dead people type movie again.
Yeah.
But I think there's even been some revision on that to where people probably look down on that movie a little bit now.
Yep, revisionist history, if you will. Yeah.
I guess you could put it that way. Or it hasn't aged well is another way to put it.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that was my major downfall. I guess you could also say Planes. I didn't think that one through very well.
Yeah.
You had some data on that that showed that
was helpful, yeah.
That
it was not number three pick worthy overall for you.
It was number four pick for me, I think.
Okay.
Maybe After Earth was number three, which sounds even worse now. But
I've got Planes as your three, After Earth as your four, and Wolverine as your five. So, but, you know, six or one half dozen of the other.
But the real story here is not to talk about the loser. It is to talk about the winner.
Oh, yes.
And the winner of this box office draft by $18 million fake dollars is Jackass Matt.
Very close. It was a real real battle this year. I had jumped out to an early lead, but the monstrosity that was Despicable Me 2. I mean, we both knew that Man of Steel was going to do great, which mm-hmm. was your first overall pick.
Aye.
But Despicable Me, you know, eclipsed it by a lot, and it did really well. So you came on real strong at the end. I was gloating a month before we were done, but you kept silently plugging away.
Yeah, and we took Iron Man out of the equation, so there was no Iron Man for us to worry about.
Yeah, we traditionally, being the slackers we are and, you know, poorly scheduled morons, we always miss the first big movie of the summer,
mm-hmm.
Which has been a tradition as well, like everything else. But no Iron Man 3 this year.
Right. So, so I had the 1 and 2 films. I think you had the 3 and 4. But what really brought it home for you was with the 10th overall pick, your 5th pick, you took World War Z, and that ended up being enough for the victory.
Yeah, it made a good amount for our purposes. I know it's still kind of panned and not necessarily considered a big winner box office-wise, but like some $200
million. $200
million. Right?
That's big enough box office-wise,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, I mean, geez, what are you expecting, people?
Yeah, exactly. So maybe it was panned by critics. I don't know. But it wasn't a movie I went to see, I'll tell you that.
So were there any movies that would save you, Tom? I want to know, like, if you lowered yourself to Hangover 3, which, you know, would obviously I would rib you endlessly, but that would have saved your bacon, would it not have?
I picked Hangover 2 last year.
Yeah.
Hangover 3, had it been available? And I think maybe it was.
I think it was. I had it written down as one
I had
my eye on, but I wouldn't pick.
A May 23rd movie. It made $112 million. So, yeah, there's a scenario in which I picked that, and I do win.
Yeah.
Elysium, which I thought was a women's perfume. It turns out it's also a movie.
That was a late August entry, which usually is kind of a kiss of death, but it did well enough. And it was R-rated sci-fi, so I mean...
Right. So if you look at where After Earth is at the $60 million mark, you add the $26 million more that Elysium made, that would have put me over the top, and I would have beat you by $8 million. But no. So Elysium, the Lone Ranger. Lee Daniels, the butler.
Never bet against Oprah. You get exactly what you deserve for betting against
Oprah. Wow. Yeah. This is the end. I mean, once we start getting up into the next few films, I would have just blasted you.
Right.
Where Are the Millers?
Which neither one of us had anywhere on the radar.
Right.
A few months ago.
Now You See Me. That was a movie that definitely could have picked, right? That was a movie we even discussed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Didn't know how well it would do. Did right. $117 million. Looked like a fun enough movie.
Yeah, it did look all right, yeah. Kind of universal appeal for adults and kids and everything.
Yeah, absolutely. The Conjuring.
Yeah, again, unusual for, like, R-rated horror to crack the $100 million mark.
Yeah, I didn't see it. Obviously, I didn't see it. Did you see it? Do you know what it's about?
I do not know. From the sounds of it, I assume it's a... you know, ghost story of some sort.
Yeah,
but.
Yeah. I mean, it has Vera Farmiga in it. She talks about having nightmares after doing the movie. I don't know. Whatever.
That poor little honey.
Yeah, Vera Farmiga.
Yeah.
The Heat.
Now, Never Bet Against Sandy.
Never Bet Against Paul Figgis, or is that his name? Paul Figgis? I believe that's his name.
It's old.
I could be just completely making up that name right now. But anyway, the guy who did The Bridesmaids...
Yeah.
And also worked with Judd Apatow on that awesome show that was in the 90s about high school kids. But I can't think about
it. Oh, yeah, Freaks and Geeks. Yeah.
Freaks and Geeks. Never bet against him when he's making some sort of gross-out chick comedy. That's the new formula that I'm writing down now. If he comes out with a movie in 2014, we're fighting for that one in round two or three.
Yeah, it seems like it's going to be a solid 7-10 slaughter for sure. I mean, it's going to do all right.
So, again, live and learn. I owe you a Blu-ray. I owe you a 12-pack of
delicious
bottled beverages. And is there anything else that I owe you with this?
You know, I thought about listening to the bet again because those were the two that I remembered as well.
Yeah.
I think that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's good. Fair enough. I remember saying, I believe at the end, I predicted that Ripped, and this, you know, I shouldn't even bring this up because it was kind of like hitting a home run off of a T-ball set, but I did say Ripped was going to do terrible, and I think that did like $12 million before it was pulled from the theaters after 2 weeks.
Yeah,
I wish Ryan Reynolds well, poor, and Jeff Daniels poorly, but that looked like a bad idea from start to finish.
Yeah, totally. And if you look at what I'm sorting on right now, After Earth was number 40 for 2013.
Well,
and you see Ripped isn't on the list at this point, so if it's under After Earth, then you can pretty much close the door on that.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't feel good about predicting that, but I do feel like I won a little bit.
there's a little bit of a win there. That's right. Okay.
Oh, Tom, you're getting emails and stuff. You know, work never ceases for you, man.
Hey, we're cool.
All right, so we're going to talk, now that we can celebrate, you know, if we wanted to celebrate me a little bit more, that's fine, too, but we're going to talk about some...
No, we don't want to do that anymore. You've got to know.
Yeah.
Okay, so on to the main event.
All right.
Cue up the cool music here. Boom, chicka, boom, chicka, boom, chicka, boom. Whatever, however it goes. The movie we're going to be talking about in the main event today is Power of the Wolf by Ingmar Bergman.
A Swedish fellow.
A man who has directed a number of highly acclaimed films.
Very much so, yeah.
Including Wild Strawberries, Fanny and Alexander, Persona, Seventh Seal. Go on and on about the movies that he's directed. This movie came out in 1968, and for whatever reason we picked this one, it's not one of his most popular ones. It is probably the only one that you can call a horror film that Ingmar Bergman has done. I don't think you can really talk about any of his other movies as being horror. I guess that could probably be disputed, but for now I'll say it's his one or maybe one of few that is a horror movie.
Sure.
Not too many people have written about it. On IMDb, 42 critic reviews, including one by one Jackass Matt for Jackass Critics.
All right.
There you go.
This was the sort of movie that I, you know, envisioned us creating Jackass Critics for, just because I remember watching it and being so excited about it. You know, it was the idea of wanting to have a platform to share, you know, that excitement with other people about. So it definitely was an exciting time the first time I watched it.
Right. It's that little hidden gem. It's that little hidden movie, a discovery that you make that not a lot of people talk about.
It clicked with me for sure.
Message boards,
and,
yeah.
You know, I can understand if somebody doesn't like it, but it definitely clicked for me.
Yeah. And it is a strange movie on a few different levels, right? So let me read you. So Ebert wrote a review in 1968 after it came out.
All right. Young Ebert.
And
RIP, my brother.
There's a couple things I've read along the way that make it sound like this movie was not well received when it came out in 1968, right? So I'll read you what he wrote.
Please.
Ingmar Bergman's Hour of the Wolf is the sort of high personal film that needs to find its own audience. The average cross-section of moviegoers won't like it, I suspect. It's a difficult film and not altogether a successful one. Bergman requires a creative act of imagination from his audience, the same sort of suspension of belief, disbelief, that Disney asks of kids to make for Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. But the adults in the audience, I observed, didn't seem up to the effort. They were snickering and whispered and made bores of themselves.
Oh.
Isn't that interesting? Frank Gatto. It's
a bold statement, yeah.
Yeah. Frank Gatto, who wrote The Passion of Ingmar Bergman, he had a pretty long essay, as he does on...
Most of his films, I presume, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's a pretty well-written, in-detail book. He breaks down a lot of the films. One of the things that he wrote about Hour of the Wolf, right, just one line that I pulled from the 10 pages he wrote on it, Hour of the Wolf is nothing short of an embarrassment.
Wow, holy mama.
Yeah. So yeah. It's...
That doesn't sound like the movie I watched, obviously. I mean, I could not disagree with him more, but...
Yeah, absolutely. And...
I guess, does that go to show how personal it is? And I don't know. It's interesting.
Obviously, there's some troubling things about the film that we discussed in our pre-show warm-up here.
Right.
So let's get into that, right? Before we get into it, sorry. IMDb has a 7.6 average rating on it. There's no Metacritic score. But there seems to be a bit of a, as I said before on the M. Night Shyamalan movie, revisionist history. Maybe there's been a recalibration of Hour of the Wolf.
Yeah.
So, and maybe this is erroneous on IMDb's part, but they had a list of the 2012 Sight and Sound best movies of all time as voted on by a group of 359 directors. Hour of the Wolf made the list at number 47, which is extremely high.
High praise.
And the two Bergman films in front of it, Fanny and Alexander and Persona, were at 16 and 13, respectively. Yeah. It placed above probably his two most popular films, Wild Strawberries and Seventh Seal. So it seems like there's been a deeper dig into Hour of the Wolf. Maybe more people were impressed by it as Ebert was when he first saw it. So
what prompted me to first watch it, I believe, I think 4 or 5 years ago when I first watched it, I think MGM started remastering and re-releasing Bergman's films.
Some of them, including Persona.
Yeah, so the first batch, I think, was Persona.
Passion of Anna.
Yeah, and Hour of the Wolf, which probably was the weirdo of the group, as you mentioned. But maybe it is due to the cult growing appreciation of the film, and I'm certainly a fan of it. But
So the film opens as Liv Ullmann is confessing and talking about her husband, who had quote-unquote disappeared. And he left behind a number of notebooks, of which she has read up on, and she talks through how he disappeared, and essentially the movie becomes her documentary or her story about what happened to Johan.
Right. There's a breaking of the fourth wall, and as we talked about, before we started recording, it's kind of unusual, even today, and I imagine at the time it was unusual, and Bergman had some things to say about why he felt comfortable with Miss Ullmann breaking that fourth wall and talking directly to us, the viewers. I don't know if you want to get into that or not, but it was an interesting idea, where he's bringing television, making it more acceptable for people to do that sort of thing. Kind of an interesting idea in 1968.
Right. So he was saying that with the advancements in television or what was going on in television, he felt more comfortable with Liv Ullmann talking directly to the camera. But even at that, the credits, you hear this banging and thumping of hammers and whatnot. It's like they're building the set. They're creating this this feel of a movie is happening and being created right before they turn on the camera, so to speak, right before you see Liv Ullmann. So even though she's talking directly to the camera, I guess they wanted to create this presence of there's fiction going on here. This isn't her as a real person talking to you.
I will say that's my least favorite part of the movie, and I don't, to this day, don't fully understand the reasoning behind it. And I know there's a quote on the wiki page for Hour of the Wolf that it was an attempt to lighten the mood, and he felt the story was so personal as a way to distance himself from it or something to that effect. Yeah. And I don't know. To me, that sounds like shenanigans, but there obviously was a reason. There's nothing so drastic happens on a film by accident. So it was perplexing for me.
They enter on a boat, a very quiet scene. They immediately start making up their house on this very secluded island. So it definitely seems like they want to be separated from the rest of the world. They want their own little quiet space away from distractions for whatever reason.
And right. It's interesting watching this in 2013. I mean, it obviously is a world away from what most of us have experienced. They're in a shack or a small cabin, I guess, there's no real electricity, there's no grocery stores or anything like that. A little bit into the movie, Alma talks about going grocery shopping, and we assume that that's like a once a month or every other month thing that she gets some food and stuff. But we also, I think, feel even at that time, you know, obviously that's a world away from where most people that can listen to podcasts exist and stuff like that. But even at the time, that's a pretty drastic step they're taking. You know, they're not arriving on a cruise ship. They're arriving on, you know, like a 13-foot boat, you know, that seems to be piloted by a fisherman with what literally what they could carry onto the boat and what they could carry from the shore, because they land on the shore. It's not like they're landing on a dock. Just, you know, I think it's important how rustic and rural this is, you know, the setup of what we're seeing here.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like it could have gone on in any century, right? They're not nailed to the 20th century. They're not nailed down to...
That's very similar to how people landed, yes, exactly, for centuries and centuries, exactly. And then you start walking and finding your shelter, because it's very, very rural, very rustic.
And there's this feeling of isolation, too, right? Like... They want to be set apart from everything, but in doing that as well, they set themselves apart from any sort of protection, any sort of neighbors that can help. They're sort of on their own.
As far as we can tell, there are two structures on this island where they live, and then, you know, the castle, which we will get into shortly. And it's, you know, as far as we can tell, there's no other living beings on. I mean, they barely show any animals, really.
Right. So Johan paints a picture or draws a picture of her in the sun. It's a very sweet moment, but then night comes, right? As we get deep into the night and we start to learn a few disturbing things about Johan right away, right? First you think, oh, this is such a sweet couple, and then he
starts... Doesn't last long, yeah.
He starts talking about the people that he's painting and drawing, the people that he sees, these demons within him, and he describes them this way. One guy is not threatening, but a homosexual. The old woman who threatens to take off her hat and her face along with it. Worst of the lot, the Birdman. Could be a real beak or a mask. He is related to Papageno from The Magic Flute. The Spider-Man, the schoolmaster with the pointer in his trousers, the cackling cast-iron woman. Right, so in a classic Ingmar Bergman way, the camera is really set at one point that captures him drawing and her watching from behind, and they sort of settle into these different depths of field so that as he's saying this, you can see the reaction on her face, and they keep their own little quadrants of the screen to themselves, right?
Their own little bubbles, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they sort of own these corners. She's maybe 5 or 10 feet away. And you see her reacting to the craziness that's coming out of him. Like, who are these people he sees, the way he describes them? You know, what is clearly wrong with this man?
Yeah, and at this point already, we view Alma, and it's only reinforced, I think, through the rest of the movie, as a fairly pure, virtuous. She believes in, you know, standing by her man in a European sense. You know,
definitely a Scandinavian sense.
Yeah, it's she's got a lot of strength. She's not a simple person or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she described herself as quiet, and that was one of the things that attracted Johan to her, is
right.
Her quiet strength, her resilience, and simplicity, which sounds demeaning, but it's not meant to be.
Right. And she's definitely disturbed by what she hears, but at no point do you feel like she's going to yell at him, berate him, run away from him, or anything like that.
It's a really interesting relationship that they develop.
Right. And still in that scene, too, where he talks about a minute is actually an immense space of time. This is just a brilliant part by Bergman, right, where he actually times this minute mostly in silence and through this deep focus where he's trying to tell her how long a minute really feels. And as a viewer of a film, if you're watching a 90-minute film and they pause everything for one of those 90 minutes...
It's heavy, man.
Yeah, you start to feel that. It's a really heavy moment. It really weighs on you as part of the audience, and you start to really feel it. It pulls you into the film. And since the whole idea behind this is that there's this quote-unquote witching hour, the hour of the wolf, this hour when all these evil things happen, it sort of weighs on you in this way that one of those minutes he's stretching out to show you how long that hour really is and how long it is for Johan in his troubled way.
Yeah, so we already know that Johan is experiencing difficulties, and we can sense how much that's weighing on him with just 1 minute of time passing. and we sense the dread building in ourselves, but yet he's dealing with that all the time. It's pretty neat.
So we start to meet some of those demons then. The next morning, old lady stops by to invite Alma to the castle and tells her about the sketchbook of drawings that are under his bed along with his diary.
Yeah.
At one point, the lady says she's 216 years old.
Yeah, so already at this point, we're not sure what the deal is. I mean, how would a random old lady know about the peculiarities of Johann's, where he keeps his diary and whatnot? I mean, there's no reason that she would possibly know that. And then the statement that she's so old, something is up. And why is that happening?
Right, right. And she starts to read the diary, Alma does.
Alma. While Johann's out, presumably painting, though maybe not so much as we come to find out.
Yeah. So in the diary, he talks about meeting up with another character who plays a big part in the film, at least a character who gets spoken of a lot.
Yeah.
That's Veronica Vogler.
Yeah.
And she's a woman that Johann apparently had an affair with many years before he met with Alma. At least they speak to it in this way. It sounds like Veronica was the one who was married, so Johann was the one who was the guy on the side for her.
Right.
So she meets
and
him.
Interestingly enough, Veronica, she's basically the third character in the film. I mean, we've got Johann and Alma, the married couple, and Veronica, who, you know, we're fairly early in the film still, and she gets introduced, and she is present really throughout the rest of the film, though she doesn't, quote-unquote, show up until, you know, near the final scene. But it is interesting, she's the third billed character, like, on the posters for the film and things like that.
Played by Ingrid Thulin, I believe.
Oh, the lovely Ingrid Thulin. And she is ever-present, I think, from this point on. She becomes a pivotal character just in spirit for the rest of the film.
Right, right. So all these demons that Johann is talking about, they know about his affair with Veronica, and they speak to it in terms as if they've been with him throughout the whole entire thing. They were in the bedroom with him, so to speak.
It's that frayed edge that they keep picking at, you know, to start unraveling, I think, you know.
Right.
Johann.
Yeah. And there's an interesting scene, too, where she's reading through the diary, and for whatever reason, Veronica just drops one side of her blouse to show him a bite. Did that ring a bell with you at all, Matt?
Yeah. Bells would rung.
obviously. So, 30 minutes in, they go to the castle, right? And Johann is there very quietly.
Right.
He doesn't say a thing, but
so they're at the castle kind of amongst
him.
These. And when we call demons, I think they're called, I kind of view them as almost vampires, because they're kind of soul vampires. And it's hard to explain, because if you view the film very literally, they're actual people. They all look different. You know, they're dressed to kind of roles that they're playing in the film. So it's kind of playing both sides at the same time, that if you just decide to take it very literally, you could say, well, this is a really weird family that lives in a castle on this island, and they're kind of being polite and inviting this family to enjoy a dinner with them in their castle and things like that.
Yeah.
But obviously we can sense from what's going on with Johann and the invitation itself, there's something else afoot. And, you know, I don't know if everybody thinks they're a demon at this point, but obviously they're demons or vampires or apparitions or figments of imaginations or whatever. But, you know, there's something going on.
Yeah, they come off as friendly, but at the same time, very strange, very weird.
Yeah.
Right? And just some of the things they say, they talk very openly about things that people usually keep to themselves, right? I embezzled the family fortune, one of them says, right?
How long did you love Johann? You know, saying, or how long did you love Veronica, you know, right in front of the wife? It's
very
terribly awkward. Stuff you would shy away from, you know, in public, obviously.
Right. They're that annoying person that knows about everybody at the party who gets really drunk and then just starts saying things as if nobody hears what they're saying, right?
Yeah. And honestly, this is one instance where you know, spoiler alert, everybody, this film is actually in Swedish, but just not really a spoiler, but it's one instance where it being in Swedish actually helps. You know, as we talked about, there's a scene where the camera starts swirling around the table, and obviously you can't pick up, you know, there's seems to be an unlimited number of conversations going on at the same time, and you can't pick up figments of any of it, and it's kind of neat because it works out really well, just because it just blurs everything together at the same time. You know, I don't know if you necessarily want to be able to pick up the figments of the conversations that are going on.
Yeah, for as much as we talk about Ingmar Bergman and his use of these deep focus type shots that he takes, these long takes on, right, where you can see somebody in the foreground, somebody in the background, maybe even like a middle ground. There's this scene or this moment within this scene where they're at the castle where everybody's around the dinner table, and they do these really fast, quick takes, these conversations that are overlapping, but they all sort of have a similar theme where where they're really poking at the subconscious of Johan as if they know his dirty secrets. They're sort of poking at them. They have this laughter, right? You can see this sort of curled up eye and this evil laugh that these women give as
the cackle
sideways.
The cackles they have is terrible.
Yeah, they look sideways. The camera quickly cuts. It almost like slides faster than it can pick up a frame.
Right.
Settles on Johan, and he's sort of there looking completely miserable, like he has to absorb all this punishment of the, you know, just these people talking about his social life and the worst possible things that he's ever done. He really doesn't say anything about it. He sits there, he absorbs it, he takes a drink. Alma just sort of sits there, not necessarily stunned, but not really enjoying herself either.
No. Yeah, and obviously they're passengers on the ride. They're not driving, and they really have no control about what's happening at the dinner and the aftermath. You know, you're literally just a passenger on the ride, they are, in this case.
Yeah.
And we're right there along with them. You know, we have no control over what's going on either.
Yeah, and then there's this weird puppet show. I'm not sure what you would call that puppet show. It almost looked like they had tiny little people playing the puppets. I think
creepy as hell.
Yeah. It has a specific name to it, or at least it did somewhere where I was reading, and I failed to write it down. But
The type of show or something like that?
Yeah, what's it called? But, yeah, creepy as hell, as you mentioned.
Oh, man, it's really weird.
And they're trying to replay Mozart's Magic Flute, or the story of Magic Flute, and they're talking about the characters of Tamino and Femina, how they come together. It's supposed to represent Johan and Alma, and I guess these characters come together through, I forget what the terms are, but through worship and hard work and all these great things. And I think they're trying to play it off where it's not necessarily Johan and Alma, but Johan and Veronica, because this is what people keep bringing up, even in Alma's presence, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And it's impressive how unplussed she is by its presence, and she's obviously a pretty smart woman and knows what's going on, but you know, she's resolved to ride it out, I guess. And it's weird because Johan is almost numb to it. I mean, obviously he's in the midst of a breakdown of sorts at this point, but yet at the same time there's little visible change in his demeanor with, you know, all these terrible things coming to light and, you know, things that would be embarrassing or terrible for a normal person to experience. But I guess it's just the continuing unraveling and breaking down of a person.
Right. And even as the party's outside, these partygoers, they swarm around him in this way. It doesn't feel like they're hanging on to him, but they keep him at the same distance, right? When they're outside among the trees in this wide road, it looks like they're in this area where he could possibly run away. It's a very open space, but the way it's filmed and the way these people are just sort of watching him, even in a long take, it feels like they're always going to be within this specific distance of him at this point, and they're not going to let him get very far.
Yeah. You know, a lot of movies seem to play around with time quite a bit, and I think in these scenes, it takes time very seriously, where it's extremely linear and we follow along in the time, but the space seems to jump around quite a bit, where we go from inside to outside, then we're at one point looking at the grounds, and then we're hopping around and we're underneath trees, but then the next scene, like, it's a constant conversation, but then we're not under the trees anymore. You know, the space is jumping around, the places are jumping around, but the time is extremely linear. It's kind of a way to play with, you know, what's going on in your mind as a viewer.
Right. And so also, too, one of the other things other than just his personal life and his affairs that the partygoers are talking about and sort of poking fun at, they're also talking about how he's an artist. And I think this is where it gets even more personal for Ingmar Bergman.
Yeah.
As a director or writer, they are poking fun at his art and how either self-important it is or how interesting it may not be or how interesting he would like it to be, but it is not.
It's right? A moment that Johann, the character, wakes up for to actually respond to.
Yeah.
Unlike most of the, you know, prods that they throw at him.
Yeah, one of the ladies says that she has a portrait of Veronica by her bed to inspire her amorous behavior, but she hangs the portrait upside down.
Yeah.
And it's not very respectful at all of Johann as an artist. And
claims she loves, you know, Veronica from the picture, right, and tells Alma that she owns a piece of her husband by having said painting in her bedroom.
Right.
A very creepy type of statements to make to poor Alma.
Yeah. And as they walk home, Alma even admits to reading the journal and confesses to it and says that she's going to stick by him. Johann really doesn't say a whole lot.
Throughout a lot of the movie, yeah.
Max von Sydow, he didn't have much to say in this movie.
Right.
So then we reach nighttime again.
And we enter the second stage of the film, if you will.
Yeah. Nighttime. And
the hour of the wolf is upon us.
Yeah. And I wrote down here at the 53-minute mark, that's not a snake bite, babe. So they do have a flashback where Johann starts revealing more of his demons in a story that may or may not be true.
It's interesting at this point. The question is, you know, anything really true at this point forward? Mm-hmm. It is maybe a possible interpretation that this is where we leave the rails and everything starts going kooky. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, some degree, some of the things with the family in the castle must not be real to some degree, but things definitely go to Crazyville quickly here.
Yeah, they just know too much about him. They know enough to poke at the areas that hurt him the most. These are like his innermost demons, so to speak, that have just realized themselves in the physical earth.
Right, but at this point, you know, we start to take part maybe in Johann's breakdown more as opposed in the first half, where still using Alma's lens, which is a bit distorted, but at least she still has one foot in reality, though I guess, as we talked about, maybe Bergman didn't think so or tried to manipulate it so, but
we'll get to that. So I hinted at the snake bite, right? So he talks about what he told was a snake bite to his wife originally. He goes into a flashback in this very washed out, very black and white scene, extremely overexposed, and it's to the point where the water looks almost totally white and the rocks around him look almost totally black.
It's very stylized and very striking.
Yeah.
And even what he does with the sound is which there's no audio for or words going on. It's just a distorted type of sound going on.
Right. I wrote that the closest thing I could think of this is, the closest that comes to this is when they see the monolith in 2001, those sort of wobbly musical sounds that are coming out of the monolith.
Yeah, it's an effect that,
right. So Johann's fishing on this sort of rocky point, and there's a boy there, right? A teenage boy, very skinny, dressed in really, really short shorts, and that's about it, who is around him for whatever reason and watching him.
Right.
He comes up closer to Johann, touches his boots, looks at him. He just sort of stands back, and there's this really creepy take that maybe goes on for about 5 or 10 seconds, but it feels like a really long take where Johann's fishing, and all you see in front of him is the water that's probably 10 feet down, and this boy you see in the foreground just looking at him, staring at the back of his head. Yeah. Like, what is going on there? So the boy eventually climbs down off that rock. Nothing really happens. He touches his boot,
And at this point, they really haven't directly interacted with each other.
Not at
so, all. So, you know, you kind of think, is this a figment of Johan's imagination? I mean, Johan looks in his direction, sort of, but it's mm-hmm. not, like, recognizing that the guy is there or the young kid is there. It's,
right.
you know, did I hear something back there? And he looks and then turns around. It's kind of a interesting scenario, kind of playing with you.
Right. And so then the boy settles down back to about where he started in the first place and starts sunbathing with his back arched, almost in a very feminine way.
It can't be a coincidence. It's very message sending to Johan. I'm not sure if that's messages to us or to Johan or what we're supposed to read into it, but it's
right.
a strong pose for sure.
Right. So there's some sort of yelling going on between him and Johan. They start to wrestle. The boy bites him and gets on top of him, squeezes him, and then Johan just sort of bangs him up against the side of the cliff. Boy, you hear some grunts on top of the music. That's about all you
right.
hear. He moans a little bit more, kicks Johan one time, and then Johan comes at him with a rock to the head. It's
very, very bizarre. So, you know, at this point, yeah. we think, well, that must really have happened. It's a very vivid thing to make up because, you know, he's envisioning himself bludgeoning a child. But it's so surreal because, you know, like you said, this is a 10-year-old boy or something like that.
Yeah.
Max von Sydow is a massive individual. He's a very tall guy. I mean, he's not a small person in any degree.
He's
and yet
compared to a
they do have
boy.
This struggle yeah. that goes on for a while. I mean, it's ridiculous for a grown man to be genuinely fighting a 10-year-old boy. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
You push him in the head, you hold him back. But yet there's this life and death struggle that almost breaks out in this fight.
Right.
That results in a murder and body dumping into the water.
Right. So the body gets dumped into the water and doesn't completely disappear. You see the blackness of the water, and then all of a sudden, a slight faint view of the head gets closer and closer, and it never breaks the surface of that water. It just sort of floats there. So you can see the hair waving back and forth, and you can see a little bit of the whiteness of the head. And it looks like it's just stuck there, maybe about an inch below the surface of the water.
Really weird, really creepy.
Really weird, really creepy. And some of the readings that go into this, right? So Robin Wood, whose book on Ingmar Bergman I failed to get before we did this podcast, and regretfully
Shame.
So, yeah, I'm a big fan of Robin Wood's essays. He was hinting at the psychological or homosexual nature that Johan is trying to repress by beating up this boy, and that this boy represents these sort of homoerotic dreams that Johan has. So, I'm reading a little bit into that because, like I said, I didn't get his essays, and it's just snippets
sure.
of what I've read. But it's definitely a reading you could absolutely take away from it, especially based on the way this boy was arching his back and the way that Johan reacted after that point.
Right. And it's interesting. So the context to get us into this flashback is Johan is telling this story to his wife. So, you know, presumably we're only seeing the details that Johan is illustrating in this discussion. I mean, is he bringing up the fact that, you know, this young boy was posing in such of a manner and he wore these short shorts and, you know, and then when
went
he dumped the body,
it
was floating an inch below the surface. I mean, those are interesting details to bring up. Those, you know, that's the context of why this story is coming about. And what we're seeing is that's how Johan's telling it, you know, not necessarily how it even happened.
Yeah. And it's very interesting you bring that up, too, because Johan is telling this story and all we get is the visual description or replication of his story. We don't hear how he exactly tells it.
Right.
So this is just the visual representation.
Is that his telling? Is that Alma's interpretation of what he's saying? You know, those are good questions.
Yeah, that's the other wrinkle on this, too, is that who's really telling the story in the first place? And that was one of the problems that Ingmar Bergman even had with this film, was identifying or justifying whose story this is. Because
right.
at the very beginning of the film, it's very much Alma who's the narrator, because obviously Johan is gone. He's disappeared.
She's the survivor, you know, of the Blair Witch that can tell the story, if you will. Yeah,
she's telling it mainly in flashback, and says that she's telling the story basically pulled out of his diary or out of his journals. And whose perspective are we seeing all this from anyway? Is it Almond's? Yeah. Is it Johann's? Does it switch? It's very problematic, and it's something that Bergman had problems with when he was making this film, admittedly.
It's interesting he claimed that. I mean, obviously he had an idea in mind, and not to try to psychoanalyze Bergman too much, but it is interesting and important to note, you know, he has had a relationship with Ullman that was tumultuous, I guess, from my understanding. I'm not a Bergman academic or anything like that, but I know they had a relationship that was very passionate, if you will. So choosing her, which he did, as his muse, as his voice, I mean, is she saying things that he wanted to say or that he wanted her to say? I mean, it does get to be layer upon layer in terms of the film.
Right.
And obviously he said many times how personal it was, and, you know, this was a representation of the demons that he had himself. And
too personal.
Yeah, we can get to that in the end. We don't want to. You know, we're going chronologically here and stuff like that, but it is interesting to note.
Right. So, yeah, as the story cuts, right, Alma has the WTF face about her, like,
right. Whoa. Holy crap! My husband just told me he bashed a child's head in.
He's a flipping psycho. Yeah, exactly.
But yet she's still there. She's a survivor. Beyonce, call out, call me.
Hey, you got the little Liv Ullman sweet tooth there.
I'm a huge fan. She's absolutely adorable. cute as can be.
Yeah, so at the 60-minute mark, I'm not exactly sure how this happens. This is another very confusing point in the movie.
Yeah.
Somehow a guy just walks in the house.
They have a conversation that the doors are absolutely locked. A knock happens. They confirm the doors, without a doubt, are locked. And then the schoolmaster or the counselor or what have you walks on in and helps himself. You know, Alma and Johann don't even speak. He asks them questions, but they sit passively as he sits and delivers his monologue of, you know,
hey, come back to the castle. Veronica's
second party.
Supposed to be there. Yeah, we're having a party. You're the guest of honor. Veronica's going to be there. And, oh, by the way, here's a gun in case you run into any quote-unquote small game, right?
Small game.
Yeah. Hmm. Like little homoerotic boys.
Yeah, that would be one option.
Yeah. So
very bizarre. You know. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you knew who that was, because I had a problem in this movie keeping track of which characters within the demons were who.
Yeah.
I couldn't remember a lot of the names. I know there's a Baron von Merkens.
Ernst.
Yeah.
And then there, of course, the nicknames that Johann applies to them, the lady in the hats and the Birdman and whatnot.
Right.
And some of those are illustrated clearly in the rooms of torture, the seven levels of Dante's hell or what have you that Johann's about to enter shortly here.
Right.
But,
so
the schoolmaster takes his leave and leaves an uncomfortable Johann and Alma sitting at their, you know, wooden table deciding what to do next.
And Johann takes the gun eventually and shoots Alma three times.
Very shocking. That's more shocking than when Steven Seagal died in Executive Decision. And that's saying something, because that was shocking.
Shocker.
I think I dumped my popcorn when that happened.
Wow. And a young man first dumping his popcorn.
Yeah.
Steven Seagal, how could you? What's going on?
I don't want to live in this world anymore.
I'm going to start my own podcast and talk about how horrible that was.
Yes. Shed all my Steven Seagal shame.
Yeah.
So no longer is Alma with us, and Johann is free to embrace his, you know, the Veronica Vogel.
Vogler.
Passions that Vogler that have just
Vogelstock.
Apparently reconsumed him amongst every other problem that he's having.
Vogelsky, yeah.
It seems.
Vogelstein. Vogelfeltman. Yeah, so
I'm going to say that wrong three more times, by the way.
It is.
I just started writing VV on my notes when I was writing about her, so.
So, yeah. he shoots his wife three times. Should be enough to kill anyone.
Yes.
And yet she's narrating the story. Does that become problematic at some point? Possibly. Possibly.
One would consider, yes.
Yet another one of the confusing points in the movie. And it does sort of get pseudo-cleared up at some point. But anyway, we're moving on here.
Yep.
Probably one of the most stylized scenes in the movie is when he does enter Dante's Inferno, as you say, right?
Yeah, it does seem like he's going from one hell to another, or each demon or vampire has their own peculiarity or something they want to extract from him that, you know, is a hurdle he has to cross in order to get to his passion or, you know, his downfall or whatever, you know?
Right. There are these very quick, like 2 to 3 second cuts in between when he's running through different parts of the castle, and they're taken from many different points of view, right? As he's running diagonally across the screen, one from the ground as you see him coming across. And I wrote in here that it felt very Wellesian to me, like maybe something from The Trial, which is one of these movies that I felt like, where making all these different cuts and sort of closing in on the character became part of the nightmare.
And there's huge sets that are vacant, you know, and they're huge, and they're interesting architecture, and there's uses of light between, you know, pillars and whatnot that kind of make Von Sydow seems small or big, but, you know, it's the size and the hollowness, and, you know, we could read into that being symbolic of Johann's soul or what have you, or at least where his head is at that time,
as being
idealized or virtualized here in the world.
Right, and he meets a number of these characters again, meets them sort of one by one, right? He meets this old woman at first, who says she needs like a kiss on her foot or something before he gets
I would suck out. Those toes like nobody's business.
And he does. He commits. He really goes hard into it. He doesn't want to do it a second time. He wants to earn it the first time.
and is that, you know, he's willing to pay any price for Veronica?
Absolutely.
Or,
absolutely.
You know, is there something else going on there?
He's willing to meet many levels of humiliation before he gets to Veronica, right? So, Chrysler playing the piano. The oldest lady says he's the true master. And then the lady, right, so he talking about him being a true artist as he's playing this piece on the piano in front of
an artist.
In front of an artist.
You know, it is an interesting
slap in the face.
Yeah.
So there's that part there, and she pulls off her face and dumps her eyeballs into wine glasses and makes everyone want to kind of vomit.
Yeah.
Very plastic, yeah. And then, my favorite part, 68 minutes, I wrote, "Oh, what a feeling, I'm dancing on the ceiling."
That was awesome. That was really cool.
It was well done. And
I mean, this, you know, unraveling scene is definitely what hooked me in and made me excited. It's
just so
simple,
creepy.
And not overdone, but it is just fascinating.
And hard to
explain.
Going
through each of these tortures, if you will.
Yeah, yeah. And then all the birds that he's surrounded by, right?
By the Birdman, yeah.
The Birdman.
Who's doing a good Bela Lugosi impression, it seems to me. But,
exactly, yeah.
Uncle Creepy or whatever from that Munsters, the Uncle Fester.
Right.
Whatever.
Fester. Yeah, I guess that's who it is. I don't think it's Fester. But anyway, I don't care.
Yeah, thank
it's
you.
One of those guys. We're moving on.
And this is the part of the movie that sold it for me. And, you know, I compare this film quite a bit to The Shining, another film that I, you know, have a great admiration for and love quite a bit, both in terms of the topics and even the plot to some degree.
Totally.
In terms of the, you know, isolation and the breaking down of our lead character here, as well as some of the imagery. And this is very similar to, you know, the butler and the bear scene and all that crazy stuff that kind of goes on with the blood gushing in the hallway.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's fair to say, a simplistic connection to draw, but if you're a fan of The Shining, I think this is, you know, an ideal back-to-back, you know, viewing of The Shining if you wanted to try to get something else in a similar vein.
Yeah, I made that connection as well and, a few years ago, and I looked it up on the internet, and there are a few other people that made that connection, too. So I guess that's
I'm not
sort
Copernicus,
of
you know, finding new ground there is what
yeah,
you're telling
me? Yeah, knocked me off my tower a little bit, thinking that I was so badass for pulling
yeah.
that out.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you like one, you'll definitely love the other in terms of the themes and the context.
No, it's totally true, though, because it's about a man and a woman who are married. In that case, they have a boy. In this case, yeah. they have, you know, a child on the way. But the man has problems with his work. In this case, he's an artist. He has problems with his, you know, dealing with his level of artistry and how successful he is at it, or maybe even how good he is or how important he is.
Yeah.
He's dealing with these inner demons in a very isolated area, right? That feeling of isolation is another part of The Shining and The Hour of the Wolf that coincide. And he's willing to kill his wife or attempt to kill his wife in order to either appease the demons or maybe he's just going through his insanity at the time and,
right,
and he takes
right.
out the violence upon his wife. And obviously the scene that comes up at the end of all this, right? You remember
the downfall.
Yeah, the downfall
of both characters. Yeah,
the Medusa head is, as they said in one of the articles I read in 1976, Film Quarterly. Right, so they both have this scene where there is the expectation of lovemaking, so to speak. There's Veronica laid out. It appears possibly dead, right? She's sort of laid
yeah.
out almost like a corpse. And
that is the intention, you know, just to continue the breakdown of Johann finally crosses through all the demon challenges to get to, you know, his true love, apparently. Even, you know, he's pushed Alma to the side now and given up literally everything, destroyed himself, destroyed his art.
Covered in makeup.
Covered in makeup for... Geisha girl looking.
Yeah.
Gets to Veronica, and she appears to be dead. It's, you know, the final breaking down everything that, you know, Johann could possibly want.
Right. And then the laughter begins at that point, right? It's the castration part, the making fun of, the mocking, the humiliation through this whole lack of sexual transfer, this sort of Freudian thing, right? As they said in that... the 76 Film Quarterly Film Quarterly article about the Medusa head, right? The Medusa head in this case is clearly represented by the boy's head popping up out of the water, right? Representing this sort of male castration. And at this point, Johann thinks he's about to commit to some sort of act with Veronica, and everybody around him within the castle laughs at him, including Veronica, to the point where he's just at this utter point of humiliation. And in the same way, too, in The Shining, you could look at it where the Jack Nicholson character, Jack Torrance, sees lovely-looking naked female within one
room
of the rooms.
212 or whatever,
212 or 237?
237.
Yeah.
Sold.
We'll just commit to that and go forward. And... he enters it, starts making out with her, and she becomes this ugly hag who just laughs and cackles at him madly. Awesome stuff.
I think we're onto something, Tom. I think we're really onto something.
We're bridging the gap there. So,
we've kind of entered the end game for Johann, and really he has his one, I don't know if it's redeeming moment, but it really is the only moment of clarity we have from the beginning of the movie, honestly, when... we have that brief moment of happiness with him sketching Alma mm-hmm. by the side of their cabin. You know, from that point on, he kind of becomes a lost character where he's either not talking or he's talking through his diary, or when he does talk, you know, it's half nonsense or, you know, he's obviously out of it. You know, he does have a moment of clarity here at this point that he's officially been broken as much as a person could be broken. Mm-hmm. He says, you know, the mirror has been shattered, but, you know, what's in the reflection?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he's about to be erased, you know, for lack of a better term,
yeah.
from the movie. And if that, what exactly that means, you know, is not necessarily clear. And I don't even know if it necessarily needs to be clear. But, you know, from that point on, he's no longer going to be a functioning partner in the film.
Yeah, he seems to commit pretty early on, too. Obviously, through the gunshots, he commits to Veronica as opposed to committing to his wife, Alma. Right? He lets the demons take over for him, take over in his mind. They get into his soul, and they, I guess they help make that decision for him. Maybe he's already made it up on his own. He buys into it, but yeah, as opposed to the characters in that they hint to him being in Magic Flute, right? He picks Veronica and not Alma, and that really, in the end, leads to his downfall.
Right.
The music kicking in, I noted, almost Lynchian in a way, especially as the you get that shot, that cut back to the water with the boy's head sort of dangling there about an inch below the surface, sort of obscured in a way, but still you know what that is.
yeah, lingering it's a very strong and raw type of instrumentation going on of effects and stuff. It's kind of neat.
Right, like lingering there almost below his subconscious, right, or at least below his conscious in his subconscious.
Sure.
Yeah, very, very haunting in that way. And then all of a sudden, what I felt was one of the most unnatural points in the film. We cut back to Alma as she's narrating the rest of the story, and she's talking about how Johan, she didn't die from that. Johan went outside for a few minutes. He was pacing around the house, came back, muttered to himself. He wrote in his journal and then went back out in the woods again. And this whole time she's speaking, there's almost like a half smile about her, and I'm thinking to myself, yeah, she got shot. And she's sort of laughing about it now.
Pregnant shot lady that's in good spirits.
Yeah.
Unusual.
Ooh, really dodged a bullet there, you know.
terrible.
Yeah, it's pretty
terrible, terrible.
It was awesome.
Yeah.
Don't joke about it. It was funny. That part felt very unnatural to me, very strange, and it defines what went on in the previous scene, at least within the nightmare, as being strictly within Johan's head.
Yes. Yeah.
Or at least whatever was in her head, as maybe she's infected, time was shortened and he came back and she heard him outside. But either way, apparently that meeting with Veronica never really and truly happened, and yeah, that was just a very confusing point in the story.
Yep. So I think intentionally, but we'll get into the we'll wrap this baby up and then maybe talk overall grand scheme of things.
Yeah,
because you know, we're steaming towards the end here with Johan running off into the woods and Alma deciding to follow him and to
and she sees,
and that's even a curious decision in and of itself. I mean. Mm-hmm. No, he just decided to kill you, and you're going to chase after him.
Yeah, with his intentions of being with another woman. Yeah, exactly.
Also unusual. I mean, Dolly Parton stands by her man, but there are limits to standing by your man, obviously.
She's not reached those yet. Being shot at three times is not one of those limits.
Bless her heart.
So, yeah, she follows him to the woods. Very creepy, very dark, very late at night. We're during the quote-unquote hour of the wolf, when most babies are born and people die, or something like that. And she falls asleep at one point on Johan, and when she wakes up, she's no longer on Johan, but she's on somebody else's shoulder.
Yeah.
Hello. Yeah.
Zoinks.
And Johan is 10, 15 feet away, and he's getting smacked around by the Birdman, getting pecked to death. And there's definitely some really cool editing going on here, right, as the Birdman zooms in on him with his large nose, but then they sort of cross-cut him with an actual raven pecking, and you see Johan, the blood coming out of him. So it's almost like he transitions between a man and a bird at the same time. It's sort of a weird...
Yeah, it's like an editing effect more than a digital effect or an optical effect or something like that. It's cool.
They definitely didn't CGI that in. Not in 1968. This is Johan's doom. For whatever reason, he sort of disappears after getting beaten up by a few of these people, getting slapped around.
Right.
He's gone. She's looking for him, can't find him anymore, and that's sort of where the story ends. She talks back to the camera. says, is this why I see the ghosts? When someone is with someone for so long, they begin to see like him, think like him. Should I have protected him better against those, quote, cannibals?
Now, I'm going to break down the whole movie for you, Tom, and I'm going to blow your mind.
Bring it home.
Are you ready for this?
Yes. Yeah. I'm holding my head, so in case my mind blows up, I can at least hold it in place.
Scanner style. So, we hear from Bergman about how personal this was, how difficult it was to write it, to film it, to edit it.
Yes.
So, if we start working backwards, I propose we get some simple clarity in that final scene. Johann's demons are consuming him. And, you know, that's, you know, I've watched enough bad television to know that that's, like, something that alcoholics talk about in AA or whatever, your own personal demons consuming you. So we get to see, you know, the Birdman take his literal bite out of him. You know, the crazy old lady in the hat start chewing away on him.
Yeah.
So Johann is consumed, and that's kind of a psychological idea that's becoming embodied. And we, you know, he doesn't show anything more than just that brief snippet and then Johann being gone, because there's no good way to do that. And to, I mean, does he become a pile of ooze? You know, that's a losing way to describe it. Just show the beginning of the demons consuming him and away we go.
And there are some interesting quotes, as I was talking about before, right? A 1972 interview between Bergman and Thomas Samuels, where he's more or less talking about Hour of the Wolf. And we talked about this before, right? Who is really seeing what's going on here, right?
So the whose story is it, and what point of view are we seeing, and all that good stuff.
Right, and we talked about how this was a problematic film and how it wasn't really received very well early on. And I think part of that could be because of the point of view that was taken from this. But Bergman's quote on that, within that Samuels interview, the difficulty with the picture is that I couldn't make up my mind on who it was about. Had I made it from her point of view, it would have been very interesting. But no, I made it in the wrong way. After it was finished, I tried to turn it over to her. We even reshot some scenes, but it was too late. To see a man who was already mad become crazier is boring. What would have been more interesting is to see, would have been to see an absolutely sane woman go crazy because she loves the madman she married. She enters the world of unreality and it infects her. Suddenly she finds out she is lost. I understood this only when the picture was finished.
I almost, and he mentions in that same interview we talked about earlier about how infected she becomes. And, you know, I don't know how much I believe that. Or I wonder if that is him retroactively applying that value to it.
He's
after
retrofitting
he had filmed it. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. He says it's true in talking about how she sees the demons, right? Because if these are his personal demons, right, if these are things that are in his head, then how do they come to life?
Right.
For him to see them, that's easy for us to justify. They're in his head. They're hallucinations. They're something he's dealing with on various planes. They've come from his subconscious into his conscious. But how would she see them?
Right.
And
that is something we talked about, you know, before. And it is interesting. And it makes me wonder if the scenes that he talks about shooting and editing in, I mean, was that the Alma quote-unquote confessionals that kind of bookended the film and kind of were inserted in the middle a little bit? Because what she does say there does insert her in as part of the cocktail, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Both at the beginning vignette of her talking to the camera at the end, she says, you know, is it possible to love someone? I want to love someone so much that I take on their personality, and you start to look like them, and you start to, you know, kind of become that person to some degree. And if we take that and read it on its face value, it makes sense that these demons that are coming to consume Johann, the schoolmaster coming in and just happens to drop a gun off and holds his monologue and walks out a locked door after he walked in a locked door. Okay, it makes sense that that Alma can see part of that, even though she can't maybe get consumed by said demons like Johann can. So I wonder if those vignettes were put in there, but I think they were put in there just to make the movie make more sense and to flow better rather than to try to make Alma the central part of the story.
Yeah, I think so too. You're totally right on that. they're in there because once you put that movie together and you start to see the problems with it, you start to think, how can I justify this given what I have already with doing as little with it as possible?
And I'm not sure Bergman worries, you know, he wasn't trying to make a linear story that made sense, but I think he wanted to try to fill in some of those holes. And maybe, I mean, who am I to call Bergman a, you know, anything other than a brilliant filmmaker, but maybe the answer is more simple than he lets on in that interview.
Yeah.
I'm a jackass. That's a more likely answer.
Yeah, and it is interesting, right? So the article, the 1976 article in Film Quarterly that I hinted at, right? Hour of the Wolf, The Case of Ingmar B. by Linda Bunsen with Carla Craig.
She invented the Bunsen burner. True fact.
Yeah, absolutely. Became a millionaire off that and then became a writer with... didn't have to make much money.
True story.
This is just passion of hers, so to speak. Anyway.
Chemistry and film. Those are my two passions as well.
Chemistry and film. She was able to follow both of them, so...
Bless her heart.
Take her hat off to that.
Yep.
Anyway, so she starts it off by talking about a review of a classical film critic, right, who takes a very straight approach to reviewing the film, saying, what the hell is going on? This is hackneyed. This is, you know, incoherent. Bergman is just too full of himself to make a really strong film or to make a film that anyone can understand. And she takes that argument and says that you can't even look at this film without even... You can't take a classical approach to this. You have to look at it from a purely Freudian perspective to break it down. And the evidence of that is Bergman talking about how personal it is and, you know, his difficulty with resolving a lot of the issues around it and how the film just sort of got away from him at certain points, right? All this evidence of, you know, how could you even make this film a straightforward film? Well, it's just bubbling through with his own demons,
problems.
His subconscious.
Yeah, he was a troubled guy, from what I understand, to some degree. I mean, obviously, a very talented, but a lot of talented artistic people,
right,
have emotional problems or whatever.
Right. Yeah, it's pretty interesting to read some of the stuff he says. So, right. So, in Images of My Life, Images, My Life and Film, there's a Bergman quote in there as well. Hour of the Wolf is seen by some as a regression after Persona. The movie was made a year after Persona, or maybe even less.
Right.
It isn't that simple. Persona was a breakthrough, a success that gave me the courage to keep searching along unknown paths. I think that's the key word there, is unknown paths. For several reasons, the film has become a more open affair than others, more tangible. A woman who is mute, another who speaks, therefore conflict, that would be Persona. Hour of the Wolf, on the other hand, is more vague. There within the film is a consciously formal and thematic disintegration. When I see Hour of the Wolf today, I understand that it is about a deep-seated division within me, both hidden and carefully monitored, visible in both my earlier work and later work. To me, Hour of the Wolf is important since it is an attempt to encircle a hard-to-locate set of problems and get inside. I dared to take a few steps, but I didn't go the whole way.
I'm surprised he views it as such a failure. It really does surprise me, but, you know, it just goes to show.
And like we said, initially it was received as a failure. I think a lot of critics probably, you know, he just came off Persona, which was received as a very high critical success.
Yeah, still certainly life-altering success for him, yeah.
Right, right. And, you know, this was probably a decade after some of his more well-known films, I guess you could say, right? Wild Strawberries and Seventh Seal. He's still known as an art house director up to the point where he's making Persona, right? So he's had a lot of quote-unquote street cred from the critical circles, and we're getting to this point where it's the late 60s and things are bubbling up, and he makes a movie like Persona, and that sort of fits into what's going on in the 60s at the time.
Very much so, yeah. Yeah, very fitting for the time. Right movie for the right time.
Yeah, exactly. And then Hour of the Wolf comes out, and maybe it's a drop-off after that, so the critics hit him hard. They're expecting him to build upon the successes of Persona and make something greater, when maybe it doesn't really happen that way.
They're crazy.
Okay, Matt, so I think we're both in agreement here. We think that Hour of the Wolf is definitely a good movie.
Definitely. Yeah, like I said,
it was a sell right there. It was a good movie.
I was excited to watch it and to rewatch it, and I encourage anyone that's interested in psychological horror and to give it a shot.
Yeah, I think it's probably maybe a stepping stone for horror. This did come out many years after Psycho did. I don't know if you could say it's in the same realm as that, but as far as getting into the psychological aspects of horror, we talked about how it was definitely a precursor to The Shining, and it wouldn't be a surprise if both Kubrick and Stephen King had seen this movie a number of times. And I gotta believe so. And it was boiling in their subconscious as the pen was hitting the paper on both the film version and the written book version of The Shining.
I
was really impressed with this film. I didn't see what all the snickering was about, and I do have a hard time seeing the snickering going on. I guess if you are not used to, in these days, I think we see a lot more psychological films, right? We see a
lot.
Maybe this did break a little ground there, so I could see how some of the demons and how they're depicted and the guy climbing on the wall.
Man, that was neat. That was a super visual, super cool.
But you can see where the snickering would come from in Ebert.
I guess you could see that as being a bit hokey if you want. But man, it worked for me.
Right. So this is definitely a movie I would recommend. I'm surprised it hasn't gotten a Criterion stamp yet.
That would be awesome. I would certainly line up to purchase that and gladly bring it into Casa de Firsty.
Yeah. Okay. I know we've done this in the past, although it's been a little while.
Yeah.
Who would you party with in this movie?
Ooh, excellent. Good call. Well,
the questions.
Veronica certainly. Well, obviously, I'm a big Liv Ullmann fan. I think she's just as cute as a button. She's America's sweetheart before, if she was American. And if Sandra
totally
Bullock
Swedish,
already wasn't
yeah.
American's sweetheart, obviously. And if it was the right decade.
Sweden's sweetheart, but yeah.
But we won't count her because, she's just too adorable to be counted. There was some good crazy people in that demon group. The schoolmaster seemed like he could take a punch, so he'd be a good wingman to have around. I'd like to have him around.
Like you could redirect everyone's anger towards him.
Yes, exactly. He'll just be the slappy that'll take it. How about yourself, Thomas?
How about the unborn child of Johan and Alma?
That's
I think
crazy.
There's something to be said there for how
what's going on
kooky,
there, yeah.
Yeah, how kooky that child would be. Who knows?
Good thinking.
May have a third arm, and that arm may be located on its forehead.
I mean, oh, boy.
I didn't take that question very seriously. Okay, Matt. Do we want to talk about what's happening next for our next podcast?
At least, our current thoughts and plans, which are meant to be broken, but currently, I was saying I wanted to go a comedy route, and we also had some plans maybe for trying to do what the kids call a commentary track.
We were going to put a twist on our little podcast, and we were going to make a commentary that goes along with a specific movie. We had toyed around with the idea of doing that for Hour of the Wolf, but I think we're going to try to do that for our next film. And Matt, since you did win the 2013... The 2013 Money. Box office challenge.
Yeah,
I'll give you the honors of picking the film. So,
right now, what we're thinking is dumb comedy, something light and easy. Hopefully, something that can produce a few chuckles on the screen, but also gives us some material to work with to make fun of.
Mm-hmm.
So, right now, we're looking at the world famous, once in a lifetime Bob Saget vehicle. Dirty Work.
The Norm MacDonald vehicle.
Well, all right. Norm MacDonald, Artie Lang, my boy, my belly brother. So we're looking at Dirty Work, and I haven't seen it. You have seen it, Thomas.
Yes.
You remember enjoying it to some degree as far as dumb humor goes. So we're going to give that a view and see how we feel about it. And
I am looking at a copy I have of it on VHS in my recording room right now.
That is awesome.
That is not a lie, ladies and gentlemen. I did buy a copy on VHS after I saw it in the theaters. And
you paid like probably more than 50 cents for it, too.
Possibly. I may have gotten it used at Blockbuster, if you remember those days.
Oh, yeah, but it was still $3 or $4 or $5 probably.
It could have been as many as 10, but
that's
beside the point.
All right.
One of my guilty pleasures is really dumb comedies that I probably shouldn't be liking, but I like anyway. So,
I'm excited about it. We'll hopefully it'll work out for us, but if not, we'll come up with something else. I know we talked about drowning Mona, and I may have to fall back to that position.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that would be great. Bring home.
So that's our plan. Now, you should also mention, Thomas, that you are no longer at Jackass Tom. We have a new Twitter persona.
Yeah, I'd been playing around with a few different names, throwing around a few different ideas. At least for the time being, I am Snakes on a Blaine, B-L-A-I-N, Snakes on a Blaine.
So check out Thomas if you get an opportunity. I'm still Jackass Matt on the Twitter. And, of course, hit up our website as well, jackasscritics.com. We have 1,400 reviews of all sorts of interesting films from lots of different reviewers.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And as always, check out our old podcasts. I believe this is podcast number 14 for us, or 13, lucky number. I don't know. We plan to get a few more in there before we are done with our lives and in the grave.
And we're going to try. You know, it's all fun. We'll try some formats. We'll try this commentary track. And, we thought about doing one that was just bullet-oriented, maybe just a quick hitter of 20, 30 minutes about what we've done, a couple of movies we've seen and stuff like that. And we're still playing with the format. There's no... You know, as long as we're having fun, that's all we're interested
Absolutely.
In.
All right. I believe it is now time for us to sign out. It was a pleasure as always, Matt.
Good fun, Thomas. Good movie. Let's do some dirty work. Whoa.
Bring it home. Later. Bye.
Tom and Matt.